This is English for International Students, a podcast for English learners. I'm Lindley.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rachel.
And we developed this podcast. We hope you love it. We spoke to Shelby Kearley, the Director of Graduate International Admissions at Texas Tech University, about what it takes to get into grad school, and we think you'll be very interested in what she had to say. Be sure to stick around for Culture Corner at the end of the episode. Okay, I am here today with Shelby Kearley, and she is currently the Director of Graduate Admissions at Texas Tech University, and she has been working in higher education for almost 13 years. She has experience with both undergraduate and graduate admissions, and both domestic and international students. So thanks so much for being here with us today, Shelby.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Okay, so obviously we are most interested to hear some of your perspective on international students.
Okay.
So first of all, I want to just ask you, what is it that you think that international students add to a university?
I actually like answering this question because my answer goes back to when I was a child. My first memories were of when my mother was in her own doctoral program at what is now Texas A&M University Commerce. I was around 3-4 years old, and the daycare facility that they had for graduate students and faculty was actually my first exposure to international students. Commerce was very lucky at the time to have several international students, primarily from Jamaica, Kenya, and India. And so in my nursery school class, it was primarily Jamaican children, Kenyan and Ethiopian children, and some Chinese and Indian students. So I learned at a very young age that it's fun to have people from different cultures around you because you get introduced to new food. We certainly never had Indian food in my house. You get exposed to different types of music, different religious ideas, different names. And it's just kind of a lot of fun to learn about that when you're younger. As I've gotten a little bit older, I've seen Texas Tech in two different time periods because I've come here first as a student in 1994 and then as an employee and as a student again in 2003. In 1994, the population of international students was much smaller than it is now. And you could tell that the population on campus was kind of made up of the same kind of students. They were largely between the ages of 18 and 21. They were largely from the West Texas area. And it was just like you were in high school because there was an exposure to different types of people, different types of experiences. And there weren't very many international faculty, at least in the program that I was in at the time. When I came back in 2003, the population had almost doubled. At that point, it was around maybe 1,200 students. And in my particular program, which was communication studies, we shared the building with mass communications. So we had exposure to all kinds of students, and it brought about more discussion in the classroom about different kinds of ideas, different kinds of theories. And again, the chance to interact with someone from a different culture, having grown up in a very small town in West Texas, it's about 30 miles from Lubbock, you don't get that exposure. So it's just nice to be around differences of opinions, differences of language, differences of culture.
Yeah, that's great. That's interesting that that process started so early for you and kind of has continued throughout your career. Okay, so you are very experienced in working in admissions, and I think a lot of students would be interested to know if you could provide just kind of a brief description of how the overall admissions process typically works for graduate students in the U.S.
Absolutely. On the graduate level, unlike on the undergraduate level, you're looking at, it's usually a two-part process. How that two-part process is run differs from institution to institution, but it's largely the same. You'll end up submitting an application. In some cases, you're lucky, and that's the common application, or in the state of Texas, the Apply Texas application, where you fill out a single profile and you can apply to multiple schools. In some institutions, it's a single application directly for that particular institution. You almost always will have to pay an application fee, and again, that varies widely, so make sure that you read on the university's website or their recruiting literature to find out how much it is that you have to pay. In some cases, you may only be able to pay with a credit or debit card. For international students, this can be a little bit tricky. If you have the 15-digit credit card in the United States, they will only accept the 16-digit credit card. So make sure that you either have the type of credit card or debit card that you need to pay that application fee, or that there is an alternative. If not, you may not be able to apply to that school. The next thing that you're going to have to send are your post-secondary transcripts. And by post-secondary, I mean anything other than higher secondary transcripts. This will be from all of your university level programs. If you have completed that program, I would recommend that you go ahead and also send a copy of your degree certificate or diploma along with that, although in most cases you will not have to provide that unless you are admitted. For those of you who are applying for a doctoral program and you may have completed a graduate level degree in your home country, I would also recommend that you have, not necessarily send at the time of admission, but have a copy of your course prospectus or course syllabi if you would like to get transferable credit for that program. If you don't, it will cause delays later on, and this is especially important for doctoral students. Then the next thing that you're going to have to provide is proof of English proficiency. In some cases, you may be eligible for a waiver of your English proficiency requirement if you have completed a degree in the United States. Some schools, like Texas Tech, have a list of English proficiency exempt countries that you should look at before you apply, so that you don't necessarily end up spending the money to take the TOEFL, the IELTS exam, because while there's a slight difference in the price between the two of them, it's still around $175, $185, and it's very expensive for students on a budget. Then it's up to the individual department, or in some cases it's up to the university, as to what type of other materials you may have to turn in. You may have to turn in letters of recommendation. I would advise you to make sure that you turn in exactly the number of letters of recommendation that they ask for. If they ask for two, send two. If they ask for three, send three. Do not send more than what they ask for. One of the things that we encounter a lot is that people will send, you know, double the number of letters, and perhaps their best letters of recommendation are that fourth, fifth, and sixth letter. They stop reading after the first, if they require three, they stop reading after those first three. So they may not see your best letter of recommendation. In some cases, you may also have to submit a written statement or a research statement, particularly for doctoral students. And if you do, make sure that you read the directions, because if you send in a statement that has nothing to do with the required topic, that counts against you in the application review. For doctoral students, this is important because they're wanting to find out, are you interested in doing research that fits in with the current department research? Is there a faculty member in the department who's already either working on a grant or will be working on some type of grant in that particular research area? In some cases, you may also have to provide proof of financial support. In some cases, like here at Texas Tech, that information is not required for your application, but it's only required if you are admitted. That's because here at Texas Tech, we determine how much you're required to show proof of based on whether or not you receive any type of financial support from your program. Some programs will also require you to either do an interview, particularly if you're interested in an assistantship. And for those of you who may be interested in artistic or architecture programs, you will be required to turn in some type of portfolio, or for the music students, some type of audition. And in some cases, you may be able to do that at a distance by sending in a recording. Or you may have to schedule an in-person audition. So I always advise prospective students, make sure that you're reading the website of both the university and also of your particular program to find out exactly what it is that you need to do and the format in which you need to do it. Because just because you turn something in doesn't mean it meets their requirements. And here on the graduate level, it's kind of a test to see if you can follow instructions. And it's very important that you make sure that you follow the instructions as closely as possible, because you don't want something that you've done unintentionally to harm your chances to get into the program.
Wow, that's excellent advice. Very interesting. So obviously every department across campus is a little bit different in their requirements, what they're looking for, but you've worked with all of those departments. Mm-hmm. And so if you can think of anything in general that helps an applicant stand out, what would that be?
Actually two things. And the first thing is actually a little bit more difficult for international students than it is for domestic students. And that would be a very strongly written letter of recommendation. Over the past 12 and a half years, I have seen some top-notch letters of recommendation. And we have seen some that are only two sentences long. I always encourage students, no matter if you're domestic or if you're international, you need to have a strongly worded letter of recommendation. One of the things that students, international students, have typically gotten from their faculty members is a very short letter of recommendation that says, student so-and-so was a student in my class in 2014, and I wish him every success. That is not descriptive enough to set you apart from applicants who are also applying for your particular program. For example, the most popular program for applications on Texas Tech's campus is the Electrical Engineering Department. Mm-hmm. They receive, on average, between 700 and 800 applications a year, a semester, I should say. If your letter of recommendation is not very well written or is not descriptive of you either as a student, as a researcher, mm-hmm. if you've had employment in the electrical engineering field from your employer describing exactly what it is that you did, how long you did it, how well you did, that doesn't set you apart. Because typically the students that we get for electrical engineering, they come from good schools here in the U.S. or good schools overseas. They typically will have a similar GPA. It's a very small range mm-hmm. of GPAs for the admitted students, and they have very similar GRE scores. So the only two items that are really going to set you apart are your letters of recommendation and your written statement. Mm-hmm. The written statement, I will tell you that some departments here on campus have a specific topic, but programs like in the College of Engineering just want you to turn in a statement. They don't tell you what to write. So in that case, what do you write? Well, if there's not something that they recommend, I usually advise students to write about a little bit about you in the opening paragraph. Describe who you are, where you come from, what schools you've attended, why is it that you want to study specifically at Texas Tech University, and then even more specifically, why do you want to study in this particular program? If you have read any kind of research done by a faculty member in the department, if you have any kind of work experience in your particular field, put that in the statement of purpose. Don't assume that they're going to read that on your resume or your curriculum vitae. What is it specifically that you want to study while you're at Texas Tech? And then finally, I recommend that they write about what is it that they want to do long term. Mm-hmm. Yes, in the short term, I want to come and get a degree here at Texas Tech University. But after I finish, what is it that I want to do? Do I eventually want to go on to work on a doctoral degree? Do I plan to go immediately into the workforce? That kind of thing. I also recommend that you do this in two pages, mostly because, like I said, you know, this particular department has 700-800 students to review their applications. They get a little tired after reading 5, 6, 7 mm-hmm. pages for each applicant. And that is kind of a way to set you apart, that you can get to the point quickly mm-hmm. and finish and move on to the next thing. Those are really the two items that I would say that would set someone apart. And that I think that in general, international students have a problem with. There are some excellent resources on getting good letters of recommendation available on the Education USA website. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Education USA system, that is a service of the United States Department of State Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. In most cases, the services that they offer are free to students. There are a few of the smaller centers in some of the smaller countries that do charge a slight fee for some of their services, but by and large, the information on how to apply to graduate school in the United States, how to get good letters of recommendation, those bits of information are free.
Okay, interesting. So I have a question for you about letters of recommendation. Let's say that a student wants to get a letter of recommendation from a previous professor, but that professor was providing instruction in a language different than English. So this student is not confident of that professor's ability or maybe desire to even write in English. How would you recommend that a student handle that circumstance?
Unfortunately, that does happen from time to time. What we have recommended in the past is that they get that letter of recommendation written in the native language, and that the student offer to either pay for a professional translation of that letter and then provide both the language that the instructor wrote in and then the translation. That usually seems to work in some cases, very rare cases. We've had the professor not want to do that, and the professor has written the letter in English. And you can kind of tell. What you can do in that case is you could provide a cover letter or a letter of application to the department that explains, my recommender, Dr. So-and-so from the University of Peridania, does not speak English as a native language and does not speak it as a second or third language. He asked to write this letter in English. You're welcome to contact him should you have any questions mm-hmm. about that. But by and large, most professors are okay with you providing the translation as long as you offer to pay for that translation yourself. And if you want to do that, if you are not able to get a translation in your home country very cheaply, because I know that some countries do charge what I consider an outrageous fee for translation into another language, there are some very good online sites that you can use to translate have the document translated professionally. And for academic purposes, it's usually between $28 and $35 a page. So as long as your professor didn't write a book, this isn't going to cost you a whole lot of money. And they can provide turnaround usually within 24 hours, and they send you the translation back as a secure PDF.
Okay, great. That's interesting. It seems like that's probably worth it. If the recommendation letter is that important, then it might be worth
absolutely.
The investment.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay, so you mentioned a couple of different things. You mentioned that it's really important to read information on the website
absolutely.
To find out what information is already there before you start getting into the application process. And you also mentioned that these departments are receiving a large volume of applications. So what do you recommend in the situation that a student finds conflicting information on the website, and or they're worried that some part of their application may have fallen through the cracks? What's the best way for them to approach someone to get some help?
I would love to say that never happens, but I can think of several instances this very week that has happened. I'll tell you right now, that's going to happen for many of you who are listening to this podcast. And in that case, there's usually two things that you can do. First thing, I would not recommend calling because the time difference, if you're outside of the United States, it's very different. It costs you a lot of money. And you may or may not actually get to speak to somebody who actually knows. I can use Texas Tech as an example, and this is the same at most of our peer institutions. There is contact information on the university's website, in this case, the graduate school website. There should be contact information also on the department website. And that's here on the Texas Tech campus, that's usually called the graduate program director or the graduate advisor. I recommend that you actually contact both of us. Why? Because here at Texas Tech right now, it's still a two-part process. You send part of your documentation to the graduate school and part of your documentation to the department. So we in the graduate school can tell you what is it that you may be missing on the graduate school's application, while, say, Jackie in the electrical engineering department can tell you if you're missing anything in the electrical engineering department. The other reason why I say that it's better for you to email is that you have documented proof that you have submitted this query to someone. That way, if you don't get a response, I would say within 5 to 7 days, you can always forward the email again and say, I just following up on this email. In most cases, you're going to get an answer back. We try to do here at the graduate school within 5 to 7 business days, and in most of the programs, they're able to answer you usually in that same time period. Jackie in electrical engineering was probably a poor example because it might be 2 weeks for her since there's only one of her in 800 applications. If you happen to be in the same city that your school that you're applying to is in, I would also encourage you either to make an appointment to visit in person, or in some cases, like here at Texas Tech, you can come to the graduate school without an appointment and visit with the first available international admissions advisor who are happy to answer your questions. And in some cases, they can also contact whoever it is in your program to get that information for you. If you are currently in the United States, it's a little bit easier for you to call and a little bit less expensive for you to call during normal business hours, which are typically 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. But in my opinion, email is the best because you have a paper trail and you can see the dates when you tried to get this information and when you actually received it.
Okay, great. So let's say I'm an international student and I'm still in my home country, but I have a good friend who's here in the city of the university that I want to attend. Can I send them to inquire about my application?
Sort of. This is going to be, I know, that's my favorite answer. It depends. It really will depend on the institution that you're applying to. In the United States, we have something called FERPA, the Family and Educational Right to Privacy Act. And one of the lovely things about this federal law is that it depends on each individual institution as to when your right to privacy begins. At Texas Tech, your federal educational right to privacy begins on the first day of the classes to the semester of which you were admitted. But because our office deals with a lot of very sensitive information that often includes your financial support documentation, your passport, biographic page, your academic records, we here at the university will allow you to have someone act as your application representative. And it's most often a family member, a fiance, a cousin, you know, family member or friend in some cases who happens to live in the same area. There's a one-page form that we ask you, the applicant, to fill out and send to us. Please don't give it to your friend or your family member because I don't have a way to know for sure that they just didn't fill it out. And we ask that you send that to us by email attachment. Then we make a note in your file. And so if your friend or your family member does come in, we can then discuss your application with them. At other institutions, the minute that you apply, privacy rights attach. But that being said, most other institutions also have a way for you to either submit what's called a FERPA waiver, which is very similar to our application representative form, to allow someone else to be able to receive information on your behalf.
Okay, great. Okay, so that was a lot of really fantastic information. Is there anything else you can think of that you wish international graduate students knew before they went through the admissions process?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
The last thing that I would advise you is you need to apply well in advance of the deadline. Please do not wait until the deadline day to apply. This is for a couple of reasons. Number one, the majority of your fellow applicants will wait until the day of the deadline. In this case, our deadline for international applications was January 15th for the fall semester. We received 3,000 applications on that day. Guess how long it takes for us to process the applications and all the materials that come on that day? We're still processing the documents that came on January 15th. The other reason, and to you it's a much more important reason, is particularly if you're applying for financial support, you need to apply early. At most institutions, money is doled out on a first-come, first-served basis. Technically, the applications here at the graduate school open up on August 1st for fall of the following year. So it's almost a year in advance. And actually, in my opinion, you should be applying a year in advance. Why? Because it allows you the time to put together all of your application materials. Just because you apply on August 1st doesn't mean you have to submit everything on August 1st. Mm-hmm. It allows you the time to perhaps retake your English proficiency exam or retake your GRE or GMAT exam if you don't feel that you did well enough. It allows you that time to get your good letters of recommendation, to write a good statement of purpose specifically for this particular program. It allows you almost 4 months to get your documents in before that deadline. The sooner your documents are in, the sooner my office will evaluate your application and send it out to your department for their decision. the sooner they have that decision in hand, the more likely it is that you're going to get a decision early enough for you to make travel arrangements to go for your visa interview, travel arrangements if you are successful in getting a visa so that you don't spend a fortune flying to the United States, and a chance for you to know ahead of time, what is it that I'm going to be doing on August 21st?
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much, Shelby. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Again, we've been speaking with Shelby Kearley, the Director of Graduate Admissions at Texas Tech.
That was a very helpful interview from Shelby in Graduate Admissions. Thanks, Shelby. Now for today's Culture Corner. Today in Culture Corner, Valentine's Day. That's right, it's almost that time of year again. Coming up on February 14th, this Sunday, we're going to talk about the history of Valentine's Day and the story of St. Valentine. February is celebrated as a month of romance, and the celebration of St. Valentine's Day includes both Christian and ancient Roman tradition. But who was St. Valentine, and how did he become associated with this day? The Catholic Church recognizes at least three different saints named Valentine or Valentinus, all of whom were martyred. One legend says that Valentine was a priest who served during the 3rd century in Rome. When Emperor Claudius II decided that single men made better soldiers than those with wives and families, he outlawed marriage for young men. Valentine, realizing the injustice of the decree, defied Claudius and continued to perform marriages for young lovers in secret. When Valentine's actions were discovered, Claudius ordered that he be put to death. Other stories say that Valentine may have been killed for attempting to help Christians escape harsh Roman prisons, where they were often beaten and tortured. According to one legend, an imprisoned Valentine actually sent the first Valentine greeting himself after he fell in love with a young girl, possibly his jailer's daughter, who visited him during his confinement. Before his death, it is said that he wrote her a letter signed, "From Your Valentine," an expression that is still used today. Although the truth behind the Valentine legends is unclear, the stories all emphasize St. Valentine as a sympathetic, heroic, and most importantly, romantic figure. By the Middle Ages, Valentine had become one of the most popular saints in England and France. While some believe that Valentine's Day is celebrated in the middle of February to commemorate the anniversary of Valentine's death or burial, which was probably around AD 270, others claim that the Christian Church may have decided to place St. Valentine's feast day in the middle of February in an effort to Christianize the pagan celebration of Lupercalia. Celebrated on February the 15th, Lupercalia was a fertility festival dedicated to Faunus, the Roman god of agriculture, and to the Roman founders Romulus and Remus. To begin the festival, members of the Luperci, an order of Roman priests, would gather at a sacred cave where the infants Romulus and Remus, the founders of Rome, were believed to have been cared for by a she-wolf or lupa. The priests would sacrifice a goat for fertility and a dog for purification. They would then tear the goat's hide into strips, dip them into the sacrificial blood, and take to the streets, gently slapping women and crop fields with the goat hide. Roman women welcomed the touch of the hides because it was believed to make them more fertile in the coming year. Later in the day, according to legend, all the young women in the city would place their names in a big urn. The city's bachelors would each choose a name and become paired for the year with his chosen woman. These matches often ended in marriage. Lupercalia survived the initial rise of Christianity but was outlawed, as it was deemed unchristian, at the end of the 5th century, when Pope Gelasius declared February the 14th St. Valentine's Day. It was not until much later, however, that the day became definitively associated with love. During the Middle Ages, it was commonly believed in France and England that February the 14th was the beginning of birds' mating season, which added to the idea that Valentine's Day should be a day for romance. Valentine greetings were popular as far back as the Middle Ages, though written Valentines didn't begin to appear until after 1400. The oldest known Valentine still in existence today was a poem written in 1415 by Charles, Duke of Orleans, to his wife while he was imprisoned in the Tower of London following his capture at the Battle of Agincourt. Several years later, it is believed that King Henry V hired a writer named John Lydgate to compose a Valentine note to Catherine of Valois. In addition to the United States, Valentine's Day is celebrated in Canada, Mexico, the United Kingdom, France, and Australia. In Great Britain, Valentine's Day began to be popularly celebrated around the 17th century. By the middle of the 18th, it was common for friends and lovers of all social classes to exchange small tokens of affection or handwritten notes. And by 1900, printed cards began to replace written letters due to improvements in printing technology. Ready-made cards were an easy way for people to express their emotions in a time when direct expression of one's feelings was discouraged. Americans probably began exchanging handmade Valentines in the early 1700s. In the 1840s, Esther A. Howland began selling the first mass-produced Valentines in America. Howland, now known as the mother of the Valentine, made elaborate creations with real lace, ribbons, and colorful pictures known as scrap. Today, according to the Greeting Card Association, an estimated 1 billion Valentine's Day cards are sent each year, making Valentine's Day the second largest card-sending holiday of the year. Women purchase approximately 85% of all Valentines. You, too, can celebrate Valentine's Day this Sunday by letting the special person in your life know how much you love them with flowers, chocolate, a Valentine's Day card, a night out, or whatever you want. If you are female and don't have a love interest, not to worry. You can celebrate the emerging tradition of Galentine's Day. This is when single ladies go out together on Valentine's Day and celebrate being single. If you are male and single, celebrate the male version of Galentine's Day with your fellow bachelors and call it Malentine's. You can even combine males and females and go out together to celebrate single life. Whatever your relationship status is, you can celebrate Valentine's Day and take the opportunity to tell the people close to you that you love them. Today's Culture Corner was adapted from material on history.com.
Today's language focus is prominence. Prominence is when a speaker emphasizes important words by saying those words longer, louder, and/or higher in pitch. We use prominence to show contrasts, just like Shelby did here.
Just because you apply on August 1st doesn't mean you have to submit everything on August 1st.
We also use prominence on transition words.
The next thing that you're going to have to send are your post-secondary transcripts.
Finally, we use prominence on any key words in our speech.
February is celebrated as a month of romance, and the celebration of St. Valentine's Day includes both Christian and ancient Roman tradition.
You can find a transcript of the interview you heard today on our blog, EnglishPodcastBlog.wordpress.com. You can also find a copy of the transcript with all the prominent words underlined. Tune in next time to hear an insider's perspective on education and history in Mongolia. Thank you for listening.